Hi, welcome to this edition of The Long View. My name is Dave Danielson, and I've hosted this program called The Long View. Our intent is to bring subject matter to you that'll help you think about the future and how these topics might impact you along the way. Our guest today is Dr. Cameron Wake, who is an associate research professor at the University of New Hampshire. Cameron, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good to have
you here.
Good to have you. Let's start off with a topic that seems to provoke everyone, and that's the topic of climate change. Can you give us kind of a broad overview of climate change? And we've got people who have immediately people who say that's awful or negative, or you have people who go to the other side and say, absolutely, that's happening.
I guess I'd like to start making 3 points about climate change. The first is I've studied climate change for the last 25 years. I'm a paleoclimatologist, and I actually drill ice cores and reconstruct how our climate has changed. And I can tell you through that process, it's very clear to me that climate changes. Climate always has changed, and climate always will change. And it changes within the Earth's climate system for a whole variety of factors, because of volcanic eruptions, because of changes in solar variability, because of changes in the positions of the continents, because of changes in the carbon cycle. It's a very complex system. But what we know today is that humans are now a major driver of the climate system, primarily because of the burning of fossil fuels. So the climate change that we've seen really since 1970, the general warming of the planet, has a distinct fingerprint of a warming that's been driven by human beings, and we can't really explain it through any natural variability in the system. So that's a big, broad sort of issue on climate change. And then we know that the warming is being driven by human beings because we use these global climate models and we can do experiments with them. And what we find is that warming that we've seen, right, can only be explained by this increase in greenhouse gases. It can't be explained by an increase in solar variability or explained by a reduction in the number of volcanic eruptions. It really has the distinct fingerprint of human-driven climate change.
So, if I understand correctly, climate change is going to happen anyway. The thing that has happened over the last 40 years is human activity has exacerbated that situation and made it a little moving quicker and making it more severe as far as the changes are concerned.
Absolutely. So there's climate changes for natural reasons on a variety of spatial and temporal scales. But what we're seeing now is a changing climate that is driven primarily by human beings. Okay. And the impact of that is primarily a warmer planet and a wetter planet with rising sea levels. And I can also tell you that the future climate that our children and grandchildren inherit is going to be determined primarily by what humans do in terms of their emissions of greenhouse gases. So the future climate is literally in our hands. And one of the reasons I think it's difficult to grasp, and there's lots of different opinions around this, is that the greenhouse gas I emitted when I drove over here today for the interview is going to be in the atmosphere for 100 years. So the impacts are a long way out, whereas the benefit of me being able to drive here is today. And it's really difficult for us as individuals or society in general to really grasp how to deal with something where we get the immediate benefits and the impact is a long way out. Mm-hmm. And so people want to see those, it's like, I want to do something and I want to see the benefit of that. And so it's a different type of conversation we need to have in order to really begin to address this problem.
Right. That would bring me in a different direction than I had intended to go, but it relates back to the idea of alternative energy choices, and that relates to, for example, alternative car choices, fueling of cars. We have electric cars now, we have natural gas cars, we have hybrids that all seem to contribute to addressing the issue of cutting down at least some of the carbon effects.
So absolutely. Mm-hmm. So increasing the efficiency that with which our fleet operates of vehicles is really important and a central platform in any strategy to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And we're making significant progress there. So we now have a new CAFE standard, Corporate Average Fuel Efficiency Standard for the United States, that's going to go up considerably over the course of the next 15 years. And we need to continue improving the efficiency of our transportation fleet. At the same time, I think we need to think very seriously about sprawl and what's happening to our communities in southern New Hampshire, especially southern New Hampshire. As we build it on these large lots, we're developing a system where everybody needs to drive to get everywhere. And it's just not an efficient system. And in the Climate Action Plan, what we the governor signed back in 2009, there was a really strong sense that what we need to do is reinvent the New England community, the New England Common Square. We need to develop these communities where I would argue everybody needs to be able to walk to buy a gallon of milk. And so it's not only improving the efficiency of the fleet, but also improving the efficiency with which our towns and cities work. And so this notion of the New England sort of common square is one that we've really grasped.
It's interesting. On a Longview, a few shows back, Dennis DeLay, who is an economist for New Hampshire, spoke about the changing population and the aging population and the effect that the population getting older is causing people to move into the center communities away from where they had gone during suburban explosion after the Second World War. They're moving back into, and he saw this as something that was going to continue to happen through the baby boomer cycle.
So, and I think that's a trend that we'd love to see continue, not just for people who are getting close to retirement, but for those people who have families that might allow their children to walk to school. Mm-hmm. So it addresses both the issue of climate change, but also this huge other issue that's not the focus today, but of childhood obesity. We need to find ways that our children can get more exercise. And having a system where they walk to school or bike to school and where they're safe doing that, I think would be really valuable. Or be able to walk to the store as well, right, to get something.
A topic that probably strikes closer to home but is very much related is a lot of folks move to New Hampshire, in particularly this area, so that they can take advantage of the businesses that are here. They can take advantage of the recreational situation that's here, where we can go skiing. They can have the beach. So they can enjoy the quality of life. Mm-hmm. That's what New England in general, and specifically New Hampshire, brings to them. How does the change in climate, and how will the change in climate affect New Hampshire and probably northern New England?
All right, so there's that's a really big question, so let me address it couple of ways. First of all, it's very clear that our climate has already changed. We've looked at a whole range of indicators from seasonal temperatures, winter temperatures, ice out dates on lakes, lilac bloom dates, sea level rise. And we see across the board that our climate has been warming. Our winters in particular are much warmer than they were 40 to 50 years ago, on the order of 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit on average. We're seeing fewer days with snow on the ground. We're seeing warmer summer nights, warmer summer days. We're seeing ice out dates occur much earlier in the season on average. And so we are already adapting to those changes. And one of the adaptations you could see in the ski industry, for example, would be that there's really not a viable ski area that doesn't blow a lot of snow. And that provides them with a resilience to really weather periods of low snowfall and to open earlier and to stay open later. So one of the things we've done is we've looked out in the future and tried to say, how is it that our climate's going to change in the future? And it's a difficult question. I'll come back to something I said before, is our future climate is really going to be dictated by what human beings do. And we have a hard time figuring out what our economy is going to do in 6 months, let alone several decades or the end of the century. So we've developed a range of different scenarios or plausible storylines of what might happen. And so if we continue on what we call a business as usual pathway, we can expect by the end of the century that the only viable ski areas across the Northeast are going to be those in the mountains of Western Maine. One example. Another example is on a high emission scenario, we would expect our forest to actually, the climate that supports our forest, to change from one that supports a beech, maple, birch forest to one that supports an oak, hickory forest. How fast that forest changes is a big question, mm-hmm. but the climate that supports that forest would be very different. And that has really important ramifications for our fall foliage season here, mm-hmm. which sort of a lot of different businesses rely on the tourists that come associated with that. We can also look at sea level rise, which we expect by the middle of the century is going to go up somewhere between a foot and 2 feet, and by the end of the century, somewhere between 2.5 to 6 feet. What is it that means for our coastal communities? We're already suffering significant flooding events during our big storms.
Right.
So that sea level rise, day to day, isn't as much the issue. It's when we get a large high tide on top of a big nor'easter that lasts 2 to 3 days in the middle of winter, and we end up washing away houses. So there's some really potential big impacts. The other piece I can say is that if we follow the low emissions scenario, that those impacts will be much less. And so there'll be much less that we actually have to adapt to.
Which brings us back, I think, to one of the original points you made, was the idea that we do have control. We have some of the effects in our hands today that's going to affect this in 50 years, which is what we'd like to think about. So things that we can do now, or things, actions that we take now, to your point, will help us help us stem the tide of the changes, I guess is what.
Correct. So there is a certain amount of warming that's already in the pipeline. There's a certain amount of warming that we've already committed to. And when we look at our projections out in the future, whether we follow a high or a low emission scenario, for the next 30 to 40 years, we can expect across New Hampshire to see a climate that's going to warm by 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit further.
Okay.
So that's something that we need to adapt to. So what does, average temperature probably doesn't mean that much to people. But what that means is that we're going to see a significant increase in the number of hot days in summer. We're going to see this trend that we've seen of these large extreme precipitation events. We've seen significantly more flooding. We've seen bigger storms with more loss of power. It's almost becoming common across the state. People are now getting used to being out of power for 3 to 4 to 5 days instead of one day. And so we expect that those trends are going to continue. And so I would argue we need to begin to figure out how we deal with that, how we plan for that, how we build more resilience into our communities, especially around the issue of flooding. I think that's hit southern New Hampshire in a really significant way. We've had these sort of 100-year floods in different locations in 05, 06, 07, again in 2010.
Right.
And it's just we're in a new climate now, and we've built an infrastructure, whether it's a road infrastructure or a power infrastructure, that was based on a climate from the 1950s. And we just don't have that anymore. And I think that's something that most citizens in New Hampshire can understand, is it's different now than it was. The real challenge is that we've spent a lot of money on this infrastructure, and we can't just change it overnight. It's going to take long-term planning. Mm-hmm. And we really need to begin that planning both at the municipal level, at the county level, and at the state level. And where I see the action right now is at the municipal level. There are municipalities that are taking the lead. And unfortunately, I don't see the action, certainly in the legislature. They're really not thinking about this in a serious way.
Right. One of the curious factors that I'd just like to examine just for a moment is the idea of rainfall. You said precipitation will be increasing over time. We know that the precipitation in the Southwest, I think, is looking out into the future, I think is supposed to be way less than what they've had already. So the aridity of that area is going to be even worse than it is. We see in the Southeast, we've seen conditions of drought as well that have become more severe each year. Are we in a cycle or in some kind of position where we're going to have these great amounts of water coming to us every year at the deficit of other areas of the country?
This is a great question. And the answer depends on what time frame we look at in specific. We are getting slightly more precipitation. That's not so much the problem, is that we're getting much more of our precipitation in fewer events.
Okay.
So a little bit more precipitation would probably be good in general, but having more big storms where we get 4 inches or 5 inches or 6 inches of rain is really the problem. Or we get 2 feet or 3 feet of snowfall instead of a foot, that becomes much more of a challenge for our system. So we have seen that already, and we expect that to continue. And so there's a whole set of infrastructure around roads and sewers and culverts that we need to address because they get washed out during these big flooding events. At the same time, drought is not driven solely by precipitation, but drought's driven by inputs of precipitation and outputs of evaporation. So really, we think about drought in terms of soil moisture, how much moisture there is in the water. And so as we look out in the future, we see the increase in precipitation happen primarily in the winter and in the spring and the fall. but summer precipitation staying relatively flat. And that's across a lot of different global climate models that we've run. So in the summertime, we expect to see a similar amount of precipitation as we get now, but more evaporation because the temperatures are going to be going up considerably. So in the future, we're looking at a world where we have more flooding and more drought. And that drought's going to be really isolated to the summertime.
And when we're talking about world, you're talking specifically about northern New England?
I'm talking about New England and the northeast U.S.
Yes, okay.
And I think what I know about the projections for the southwest United States is that they are going to continue to dry. So we expect the mid-latitudes to get wetter, but the not really the tropics, but sort of the subtropics to get drier. Right. And that's going to be their challenge.
Agriculture isn't as big a piece of the economy as it was back many years ago, 50 years ago, but it still is a good piece of the economy in New Hampshire. There are many local farms, farmers markets who have been started up, and what concerned me was there's going to be precipitation in the spring, but we're going to see not so much during the summer, which would be a part of the growing cycle. Do you see that being an effect on our agricultural community?
Absolutely. So there's going to be tremendous challenges for the agricultural community. The first is you think, well, warmer temperatures, longer growing seasons, that's going to be great. So there might be some crops that we can grow in the future that we haven't been able to grow viably in the past. Unfortunately, I think that advantage is going to be reduced considerably because with the warmer temperatures and the higher CO2, actually favors a lot of different weeds and pests. So we're already getting pests into this region that farmers have not seen in the past. And so the folks that grow corn in upstate in across New York, they've seen this pest called disease called Stewart's wilt, which they've never seen before, but it's coming to the area and it has a significant impact on the corn crop in the southeast. And so we expect there to be this increase in pests and weeds. There's another weed called kutsu that if people are from the southeast, they know about. Right. It's invasive that was brought over from Japan. But it just grows out of control, and it's controlled by cold wintertime temperatures. So we expect to see more of it. But what we know is that in those warmer temperatures with higher CO2, weeds especially they're also more vibrant. We also see that poison ivy will actually, not only will there be more poison ivy, but the toxins in the poison ivy will be stronger than they have been in the past. And they're more resilient to herbicides and pesticides for pests. So farmers that aren't doing organic actually will have to use more pesticides and herbicides. And those that are organic farmers are going to have to pay more attention and spend more time in terms of dealing with weeds.
Two words that you've used that I know that you've done a lot of your work in, and I want to try to explore both of them if we could as it reflects back on the climate changes that we're talking about. One is the word resiliency mm-hmm. that you've spoken to, and the other is the word sustainability that you've spoken to. Could you help us with that?
Yep. So we've really begun to think about this issue of how we deal with climate change and especially adapting to the change that's already in the pipeline from the perspective of resilience or resiliency. And we define that as the ability of a community to bounce back after right. there's been some sort of impact on them. And perhaps the best example I can give for that's a really useful example for New England is snowfall from a big nor'easter. We set our town budgets, in March. We put out money to pay our employees and to make sure our trucks are maintained and so that we have salt and sand. So when the snow season comes around, we can deal with it. We get a 1 or 2 foot snowfall event. Maybe we close school for a day. Everybody's pretty happy because they get to go out and walk around and ski.
Right.
And then the next day we're back to work. You get a foot of snowfall in Washington, D.C., and it shuts down for a week. We are pretty resilient because we have a system that's grown up with that and mm-hmm. we've addressed it, whereas Washington, D.C. has next to no resilience. So in light of climate change, in light of these more heat waves that we're going to have that really affect the elderly and the young, more air pollution in the future because it's hotter, it's going to be creating more ozone, more flooding events, perhaps more drought in summertime, how is it that we're going to develop our community so that we are more resilient? And I think that's a conversation that we need to be having in our communities. And I think that's one big piece of sustainability. And I guess that's a really big topic, perhaps one for another show. But I'd really suggest that people think about sustainability not in terms of providing shelter and food for the future, because we're much more than that. Mm-hmm. I'd really ask them, what is it that sustains them? And when we ask people that, especially our students at UNH, you know, it gets very complex. It's music, it's art, it's education, it's family, it's relationships, it's love. And I think we like to think of sustainability as that big picture. You know, what is the good life and how do we pursue that good life? And I think the argument we would make is a good life that includes a stable, somewhat predictable climate system, and one where we're not spending most of our resources reacting to these extreme weather events. I think it also involves a pretty serious question about being the difference between being a consumer and being a citizen. We are often asked to go out and shop more to help our economy. Right. And I would argue what we need to be asking people is to play their role of citizens of this state and of this nation so that we can really move forward. So sustainability is that big picture for us. And how we pursue it is not... It's a concept for us that's very much like democracy or justice. It's not a pat definition. It's actually defined in a place by the people in that place as they move forward. But we really need to be having those conversations and bringing in all of the various transformations that are occurring in our society right now.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned a book that we should make available, at least the title available. People can write to us, and you and your colleagues put together a book on sustainability.
Yeah, so it was a book that was led by our provost at the time and our chief sustainability officer at the University of New Hampshire, and it's called The Sustainable Learning Community, One University's Pathway to the Future. And it's there's 60 of us that actually contributed to it, basically reflecting on you can call it the work that we've done on sustainability over the last decade at the University of New Hampshire. And so we sort of break it down in that we have four key activities at the university. We work on curriculum, we have operations, we do research, and we're engaged with communities. So we call that the core. And so we talk about how we've addressed sustainability issues across all of those activities at the university.
Excellent. And I think, too, again, if I understood correctly, your concept of sustainability really looks at what we would perceive the quality of life.
Yes.
Why people have moved here, why people live here, why people continue to live here over generations is because the perceived quality of life, and understanding that the quality of life, I'm just summarizing this for myself, actually, understanding that the quality of life is going to be affected by this gradual change of climate change, which we've already started to see happen. I think maybe some folks in the southern part of the state would say that foliage change seems to happen later than it used to. By October 12th, I think we used to say Columbus Day was the trees were bare.
Yep.
And now, not so.
I would really emphasize that point that we are already seeing the changes and we are already adapting to them, but we're not really doing it in a systematic way. The other point I think that's really valuable here that you've already mentioned or alluded to is that there's this myth that I hear propagated frequently that it's about the economy or the environment. And I think one of the things that I love about New Hampshire, and I came here 25 years ago, is that our economy and our environment are actually intertwined.
Yes.
And that we can't really sacrifice one for the other, that we really have to figure out ways to move forward and to promote both of those together as an integrated system. And one of the aspects that came out of our climate action plan that we did across the state was that actually becoming more efficient with the way we use energy, developing additional renewables, is actually going to be really good for our environment because we're going to be emitting less greenhouse gas emissions. But for every dollar that we don't spend on fossil fuel, because we don't have any fossil fuel in the state, that dollar gets recycled within the state. So becoming more efficient is really good for the New Hampshire economy. And one of the big ways we need to do that is we need to renovate our housing stock. It's a relatively old housing stock. It's relatively inefficient. And we could make great gains in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions by renovating that. But those are jobs that you can't outsource to China. Those are jobs here on the ground. There's close to 500,000 homes in New Hampshire, a significant percentage of them that need to be renovated. So there's a whole opportunity to actually develop a new economy that's good for the environment and good for our economy.
And a major sector of New Hampshire's economy is the construction industry. So that's interesting. We talked about, in the little time we have left, What do you perceive? What would you perceive as a worst case scenario? What could really? How could the environment really damage the quality of life that we have in the next 30 to 40 years?
I think the worst-case scenario is that these big precipitation events just continue to occur and get bigger at the same time that we're developing our watersheds, and if we don't deal with sprawl, so we have lots of our watersheds being paved over, and that results in bigger floodings. And then so more of what resources we have available to state and local governments actually get funneled into fixing roads or fixing wastewater treatment plants or dealing with infrastructure in a reactive way instead of a proactive way. Okay. Sea level goes up by 2 feet. So we begin to have significant impacts in Seabrook and Rye and Northampton and Portsmouth, and we're just trying to build seawalls. We're just trying to react to a situation, and all our money goes away. And then another part of that is that if that sea level does go up by 2 feet, there's literally going to be hundreds of millions of environmental refugees from across the globe. And they're going to be looking to areas that are secure that they can move to. Mm. And so it takes the whole immigration issue that now is a political hot button issue, right, and really ramps it up considerably. And so do we say we're going to take those immigrants, or do we say we're going to be Fortress America and we're going to do everything we can to keep them out? So it could have some very important geopolitical ramifications. And that's not just the climatologists saying that. If you look at Pentagon's quadrennial defense review, for the first time, they've now integrated climate change as a key aspect that they need to address in terms of the security of this nation. Right.
And I think you've led us on a good path, I think, for improving our quality of life by becoming more aware of the climate. And could you sum that up one more time for us?
Absolutely. So I think that first and foremost, in the state of New Hampshire, we shouldn't look to government to solve our problems. So government's part of the answer. But really, we need to act across all sectors of society. So you think about family and religion and government and business and academics to actually begin to discuss how it is we're going to address this issue of climate change, both in terms of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and planning for the change that's already coming. And I would argue that if we're smart about it, in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, we can actually really significantly benefit our economy. So a best case scenario, 30 to 40 years out, is that our climate's warmed a bit. We have maybe slightly more flooding, but we've begun to address those issues by making our communities more resilient. And we've developed a whole new economy that supports local jobs around being more energy secure and being more food secure. Excellent. And really elevating, I think, the value of the citizen over the consumer.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much for being with us today. And I hope we could take up your offer to come back and talk about sustainability, either yourself or if you could refer one of your colleagues over to us. I'd love to have that conversation if we could, because the integrated approach, I think, is one that folks would be really interested in.
Absolutely. Would be happy to come back. And I think a way to end it, that integrated note is really important. This is all connected, and we're all connected, and the sooner we realize that.
And we're going to put up a couple of websites for folks to look at that you have suggested to us. One was www.climatechangene.
So one was www.climatechoices.org. And so that really reflects a large Northeast climate impact assessment,
right,
that grounds a lot of what I've talked about in terms of climate change. Then another one is a project I direct at the University of New Hampshire, www.carbonsolutionsne.org. And that's one that really focuses on a lot of the research that we're doing at the university and our engagement with the community.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, David.
I appreciate having you. And thank you very much for looking into the long view. We hope that we've stimulated some ideas about how the climate's going to affect your life in the future and how your family is going to look at the quality of life in New Hampshire and in New England. Thanks very much for looking into the long view.